You're with the Country Breakfast on RN. Let's head out with our rural reporters. This week, do you like prawns? If you do, then you're in good company. Apparently, Australians just love their seafood, and there's a real push on to increase supply. What better way to wash down the prawns but with a nice cold beer? This one's brewed on site at a vineyard in South Australia. And settle back to watch a bit of trans-Tasman rivalry. It's not the Bledisloe Cup, but it's serious business at the sheepdog trials. Also today, you'll meet an egg farmer who's found a perfect way to protect his hens from predators. And a bit of a clue, it's showy and flamboyant.
He's about 3 years old now. From memory, they get to about 15. So they can get quite old. We initially got to help against snakes. And we found in the meantime that haven't had any goshawk attacks. And we think it's just because of his size.
Oh, this was the story that got even the Russian media interested this week. Have you got any clue what he's talking about? We'll find out later in the program. First stop today, though, tropical North Queensland, where the prawn farms are battling to keep up with demand.
As an industry, the demand for prawns in Australia locally is insatiable. The customers love our product and they want more of it, so it's good.
Matt West is a busy man. He's the general manager of the company Australian Prawn Farms, and right now he's overseeing a major expansion of this aquaculture farm just south of Mackay in tropical North Queensland.
And there's many other farms around Australia that sell predominantly to the supermarket chain. So I would have a guess that probably in the vicinity of say 80 to 90% of all the product produced in Australia at the moment go to the supermarket chains.
Hello, I'm Lara Webster. The company's increasing production by 50% to meet this insatiable demand for Aussie-grown prawns. They hope to harvest more than 600 tonnes of black tiger prawns this season. But it's not without its difficulties. Domesticating or breeding prawns in captivity is fraught with problems.
So this is the maturation rooms where the broodstock prawns are. It's kept dark to keep the stress down for the prawns.
Tony Charles is the hatchery manager here. He now has 300 breeding females producing a whopping 16 million babies a year.
And what the guys are doing in the tanks now, they're shining a torch down their tail and checking for eggs. And when the eggs, when there's enough eggs in the prawns, they pull them out to spawn. That's what the guys are doing now. See the eggs down the side there? There's eggs down the back. For that dark patch. And that's the ovaries. So when they start to bulge out the side and they get thick and black, that's when they're ready to spawn. That one there is particularly good.
So essentially, Tony, you're very much like the midwife here, aren't you? A little bit.
Yes, yes.
So as we that's walk exactly through right. The hatchery, what's involved in caring for these?
Nutrition is paramount, so we need to feed them really well. These broodstock prawns get fed a marine worm. That's about $132 a kilo, so it's quite expensive. They also get fed squid, mussels and a commercial maturation pellet. On top of the nutrition, the tanks have to be kept clean. We can see right through this water. They get 24 hours a day. They've got water going through the tanks. And they also get a water exchange, so you need good quality water, good quality feeds, and try and keep the stress down, keep the lights out, and minimal noise and whatnot.
Like any human hospital, these pregnant tiger prawn mums are shifted to a special birthing suite or spawning room when their time comes. It's one of the quietest rooms in the hatchery.
There's 30 tanks and we put one prawn per tank. They stay in here overnight and they usually spawn around about between 6 to 9 p.m.
And each tank, obviously like Tony touched on before, we've got one prawn per tank, so it's all about traceability. We can trace whatever's in the ponds all the way back almost to what prawn it come from. So when we look at domestication and we're looking at traits and genetics and so forth, that's a really important thing to do. So this hatchery is set up very, very well to be able to ensure traceability.
So when they spawn, the eggs are probably around about 200 microns. So that's about 0.2 of a millimetre. We drain the eggs onto a 100 micron screen the morning after, and then we take them into the hatching room, the nuclear room. So we've got a separate maturation room where the mother and fathers live, a separate spawning room, and then a separate hatching room. the sole purpose of trying to keep the risk of spreading disease to a minimum. Right, so over here's my favourite room in the hatchery. This is the hatching room. So it doesn't need to be dark. Actually, light is better because the little Norpley eye, they're called when they hatch, they're actually phototactic. So they swim up towards the light and that gentle flow of water takes the hatch babies across to another bucket in another water bath, essentially separating the Norpley eye from the egg casings. So it's a nice and clean system.
How long are the babies in here, so to speak?
The babies are in here only for around about 6 or 7 hours and we harvest them that afternoon. So the timeline, to go back to the maturation rooms, we pull out the mothers about this time of the day, about lunchtime. They spawn about 6 to 9 p.m. 14 hours later, we get the babies, the Norpley, and then they go out to the growing tanks. So these hatch babies, they're probably around about 200 microns, 200-300 microns, so that's about 0.2 to 0.3 of a mil. And if you look very closely and try and focus on one, which is hard, sometimes you can see their little arms and legs flicking about.
Can't see anything. It's sort of, for those who are listening, it just looks almost like a, you know, when you pour some salt into a glass of water. Look at that. That is incredible. From the hatchery, the tiny baby prawns are sent to yet another growing out tank, where they'll stay for 30 days. Then it's out onto the farm. And in about 3 months, they should be big and fat, ready to harvest.
And now we're in the larval rearing rooms. So those Norpley that hatch out, we put them in these 10,000 litre larval tanks and they stay here for right on 30 days until they're ready to be put on the farm. So we've got 68 of these larval tanks. So every morning we walk around and we inspect every single tank and we judge them on water quality, how much food's left over, the health of the prawns, and we increase or decrease water exchange and the feed amount based on how they're looking. So we really have to try and maintain optimal water quality and optimal health for these babies to maximise survival and to get the growth rate up.
For Matt West and the team at Australian Prawn Farms, farmed prawns are the way to go. Through careful genetic selection and breeding techniques, they believe they can meet growing consumer demand for their products.
You know, we can also start selecting a lot more based on customer, what the customer wants. So, you know, specific colours, believe it or not purples or something, but different intensities of red, vibrant colours in the prawns, sizes, particular sizes that grow at certain times of the year, particular diets that we can feed them, all these sort of things can contribute to better sustainability. So, like I said, it's definitely the way of the future and it's something that we're dead keen to continue.
So this one's an American dark ale. So it's got colour that makes you think of a stout or a porter. But really,
in some ways, 26-year-old Tom O'Reilly is living the dream. Shacked up in an old shearing shed beside a biodynamic vineyard, he spends his days surfing, doing yoga, and perhaps most importantly of all, brewing beer.
Where it's American is I've got lots of hops in there. So particularly I'm trying to get that sort of mango, pineapple, chocolate type combination. So,
hello, I'm Cassie Steve at Cape Jaffa on the edge of the Southern Ocean in South Australia. Free spirited Tom was tripping around Australia when he ended up here looking for a job at the winery. His brewing skills quickly got noticed, and soon the winery will be pouring both wine and beer at the cellar door.
Start tasting it with your nose, and you get the hops play around with that chocolate and caramel a little bit.
It just goes to show that sometimes the best things in life happen completely by accident.
Actually, I was sort of on a trip around Australia, taking a bit of a sabbatical from the brewery that I've been working at for the last few years up in Byron Bay. And I end up getting around here at sort of vintage time. So that's the time when wineries are looking for a lot of work in order to process the grape material and start turning it into wine. And so considering there's a degree of relatability between making beer and making wine, I was sort of offered a job on the spot. And I was pretty keen to learn about biodynamic viticulture and winemaking and stuff like that.
But you were travelling across the country and you just kind of got stuck here.
Yeah, pretty well. I mean, travelling's pretty great, but, you know, bedrooms are pretty good as well. So
this is but a pit stop on your broader journey.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think a lot of Australians, you know, have a bit of a dream to do the trip around Australia. And
so the Southeast hasn't lost you yet. You're still here for a little bit longer. So tell me about what you're actually doing in this humble shearing shed.
I guess the way it kind of turned into a bit of a beer project was that Des, who's pretty keen beer drinker, he's been growing hops here for a few years, and he procured one of his mate's homebrew setups, which is actually a pretty good homebrew setup, really. I thought I'd utilise it to make some knockoff beers for us whilst we were doing the winery work. And so from what started from just making some knockoff beers on a pretty good system, and, you know, we've got a proper tap system and everything here, turned into an offer from the winery to pay me a wage to brew beer part-time.
So this is literally the definition of the most organic process you can imagine.
Yeah, the pun definitely applies. Been a very organic process here in the BD, vineyard brewing beer. And I guess, you know, part of that is enjoying getting to know the area and kind of treating it as like a holiday.
And what are you actually brewing? Which kinds of beer?
A few different styles of beer, but really there's the traditional styles of beer that come from Europe and from the UK. But I'm tending towards the new methods which are coming out of North America in the way of making beer. So, and that's mainly revolves around trying to infuse as much hop flavour and aroma into a beer, because we've now got all these really interesting, pungent, fruity, resinous cultivars of hops that we can use as brewers. So it's our beers all focus around big hop character. My brew house, it's stainless steel vessels, because obviously heat is involved in it. Yeah, so you need to be able to get them nice and warm. Here's some of my malted barley. So it's barley that has been taken to a maltings, and the maltster has then germinated the grain and then kilned it so that you get flavour in the grain, whether you want toasted notes, roasted notes, caramelised notes.
What do you enjoy about brewing beer?
Well, being a poor uni student and not being able to afford to buy the amount of beer that I wanted to drink, that was certainly a big push to making beer. But really, it came from the cool fact that when you're making beer, you've got like a little ecosystem going on. It's not actually a brewer who makes beer. Brewers make just the first part of the process, the wort, the sweet sugary liquid that is coming from the grain and flavoured with hops. It's actually yeast, the microorganism, the fungus, that turns those sugars into alcohol, ferments it, and therefore makes the beer. So I think that's probably the thing that I still marvel at with beer. You're drinking the product of, you know, a biological product, just like a, you know, an artisanal cheese or a sourdough bread. It's something which is, it's microbiological. I just think that's so cool, just personally.
Beer brewer Tom O'Reilly sounds like he's doing it tough there at Cape Jaffa in South Australia. Still to come on A Big Country Today, the mystery chicken protector on Queensland's Sunshine Coast, and Trans-Tasman rivalry is alive and well in the West.
That dog's doing quite a nice job, but and see, he's at that next marker, and the sheep have just come through in time, so he's not losing anything. He's doing a very good job of this.
Forget about the rugby and the Bledisloe Cup, all of the intense rivalry of the Trans-Tasman netball competition. It's all on the line here at these showgrounds as Australia and New Zealand battle it out in the Supreme Australian Sheepdog Championship.
This dog's got a beautiful touch with it, it's just not upsetting them at all. Very nice. My name is Graham White. I'm the president of the New Zealand Dog Trial Association. And I'm over here as team manager and judging for the New Zealand section.
Hello, I'm Michelle Stanley at Northam in Western Australia, about 100 kilometres east of Perth. More than 200 sheepdogs and their trainers have travelled from all over Australia and New Zealand to test their skills.
It's like going out on the first date. You don't want to rush. You just want to be very careful not to frighten them off. This is beautiful work.
The dogs need to move a mob of three sheep through a series of obstacles within a set time period.
The sheep's already looking to go over there. Look at that, beautiful. beautiful work.
And competition is intense as the Kiwis try and maintain their proud tradition in the sport.
I've been trialling for about 35 years and I've been in the administration side of it for 20 years. We have about 4,500 competitors at home from 160 clubs right throughout New Zealand, ranging in the age from school children right up to an old friend of mine who's 92 years old and still very competitive.
How does that compare to Australia? Is it more popular over in New Zealand?
Oh, it's more popular because of the huge distance you people have to travel here, and they tell me, you know, once there was about 120 million sheep in Australia, and you're down to about 70. Similar to home, the sheep numbers are going down, and so therefore there's not so many dogs about.
How did you get into it back, you know, when you started?
Oh, I was about 14, and I saw some old fellas. It was a trial, one of the longest running trials in the Otago Centre where I came from. And I just fascinated what these dogs could do, and I've just had it's like people that get hooked on fishing or golf or anything else. Once you get it in your system, it's just there. Good, you see the man's quite relaxed about it, so he knows things are going pretty good. And if you get tensed up, it flows onto your dog feels it.
Simon Leaning, sheepdog trainer, and I spent 2 days judging the dogs and the trialers. And I'm also a competitor, so I've had 3 dogs in the event. What's that, hey?
Simon Leaning is one of the Australian competitors trying to wrest the trophy from across the Tasman.
Hello, beautiful.
She's one of those dogs that when she hits you with a tail, you know that she's hit you.
She's a beautiful dog. She's mainly black with a little bit of, I guess, cookies and cream, you might say, on her front. What's her background?
Well, this is Floss, and well, she's come from Grass Valley as well. She's partially Grass Valley and also partially Boyley lines, and they're a couple of very famous sheepdog lines over here in Western Australia. You can see she's a short-coated dog as well, which is really important in this hot weather.
So what are some of the challenges?
Well, I guess the biggest important thing is to select the right dog, get some good breeding. Once you've got a good dog with a good sound temperament that suits you, a lot of the training is based on what the dog does naturally, and we assist it to develop it along those lines using that natural instinct. And add to that some commands, and of course at the higher level it's a little bit of micromanagement, tiny movements, small little assistances to get the sheep in the direction you want them to go.
How can you micromanage a dog? Because it's not as though you can sort of, you know, move it that one step in that easily. How do you do that?
Well, it's repetition, training and reward. And the reward for the sheepdog is sheep. So if you say to the dog, stop, and he stops, and then you release him to have the sheep, he gets a great reward. Much the same as perhaps an obedience instructor might give a little food treat, we allow them to have the sheep. So they quickly learn. They're asking you, how do I get to work my sheep? And we say to them, well, if you hold it for a second, now you can have them. They look to work with you as a team.
How long does it take to train a good sheepdog?
Well, look, it's a lifetime thing. So dogs are always learning and always developing. Some of the better dogs, the ones that are winning the big sheepdog competitions, are in their prime, 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 years old. But a sheepdog can go on to the sheepdog trial at a good age is about 2, because they're physically grown and mentally settled, and also you've put some time in on them.
And then there's the perennial question. What's the best sheepdog? A Kelpie or a Border Collie?
Are Collies generally the better dog to train?
So there is a difference in the temperament. A Kelpie's always asking you what for. Very Australian, isn't it? And whereas the Border Collie's saying, how can I do that again for you? It's a trainability thing. Independent thinking dogs like a Kelpie are fantastic working big mobs of sheep where they can problem solve. Border Collies tend to be able to be trained or managed a little bit more with a human input.
We'll just chug it gently. Look at that. Look at that. That's beautiful work.
Australia versus New Zealand. Who is the better team at the end of the day?
The one that wins.
And who will that be this week?
Oh, well, we've won it the last 2 years, so yeah, we've got to be confident. And we are confident. There'll be a roar from the crowd shortly, I bet you. Listen, look at that, that's nice work. Beautiful. that could be easily, that could easily be a 96.
Gosh. Oh, you're looking great. Look at you. You're a pretty girl, aren't you? Hey.
Meet Mark Bergender, an egg farmer on Queensland's Sunshine Coast. He loves his free-range pastured chickens and wants to protect them at all costs. G'day, I'm Marty McCarthy, and I'm here to meet a very special bird.
It's one of the old bigger birds. It's very, very, very colourful. It's got a very nice crest on the head, long, nice tail.
This bird has one important job, to protect the hens from predators. So you might be surprised to learn it's the scariest bird of them all.
It's a peacock. It's brilliant blue and brilliant green and in the right kind of satellite, also gold.
That's a peacock.
Oh.
He decided to turn up.
Okay.
He's often just around.
That's right. Mark's first line of defence against predators isn't a shotgun. It's a fabulously flamboyant ball of feathers.
His name's Percy or Percival, the Magnificent. He's about 3 years old now. From memory, they get to about 15, so they can get quite old. We initially got the peacock to help against snakes because we read up that peacocks kill snakes. They don't just scare them away. And yeah, we found in the meantime that haven't had any goshawk attacks. And we think it's just because of his size. Just because the goshawks see a big bird like a peacock and they just go like, not going there. Amazingly enough, he's a very good flyer. He flies really well. I would have never thought that he would fly as well as he does. He jumps from standing straight up on a roof.
I imagine as well when he puts his majestic tail feathers up, that's pretty intimidating for other animals as well.
It may look intimidating. For us, it's more funny. Because he shows his tail almost all the time, to us, we see it as he's having an erection. So we're having constant jokes about, oh, there he goes again, and no one's interested.
It could work the other way. He could start attracting some birds.
I'm just wondering, what kind of birds would he attract? Well, we haven't actually had any birds attracted to him as such yet. I think the chickens have worked him out a bit when he displays to them. There's always one or two that stick around the front to keep him entertained, you know, to keep him busy. And then there's a few that just go around the back and start pecking his tail feathers.
Well, these are egg-laying chickens and they're a bit clucky. Do they ever go for him?
Yes, he's had a bit of a go at some of them. I don't think it'll be viable, whatever comes out of it.
Has anyone ever crossed a chicken and a peacock?
I don't
know. Or tried?
I'm sure people have tried. People try all sorts of stuff. I don't think it's a viable combination, just because of the size. I mean, a peacock egg is the size of an emu egg. I can't see that coming out of a chicken.
Right, so he keeps away the hawks, but does he keep away the foxes?
No, I don't think he does the foxes. We know he doesn't keep away feral cats. We've had a feral cat attack recently. The thing as well is we've only got one peacock. And we've got 30 acres, so he can't be everywhere at all times. He does like to stick around with the laying flock more than anything. That's where we want him, really. But having multiple peacocks is not a good idea because they will attack each other and they will kill each other. So yeah, in general, you need about, if you have peahens as well, in general, the rule is you need about 16 peahens before you can think about a second peacock.
Right, so he's well and truly on his own protecting this flock for the not too distant future.
I would say so, yes. We don't want to get too many of them. They are noisy.
But he's doing a good job by the looks of it.
Oh, we are happy. We are happy. He's a pleasure to have around. He's actually fairly tame. If you get him at the right time, he's going to eat out of your hands, which is unusual for a peacock. Most peacocks will never come that close.
Sunshine Coast egg producer Mark Bergender speaking about his flamboyant and very noisy chicken protector, Percy the Peacock. Now, just an update as well on those Supreme Australian Sheepdog Championships. Unfortunately for the locals, the Kiwis have taken out the trophy for the third time running. Better luck to the Aussies next year. You're with the Country Breakfast on RN, Edwina Farley with you.